At this time, let me invite you to turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. This is found on page 670 in your pew Bible. 670. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, we'll begin at verse 1 and we'll go as far as verse 11 this morning. And this does serve as the introduction to this entire book. So with that, pay attention. This is the Word of God. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, "See this, it is new"? Already it has existed for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. This ends the reading of God's holy and infallible Word. Well, we've begun to look into this sometimes misunderstood book, which is filled with wisdom that confronts us with reality from God's perspective. We considered last time we were together the main theme of the book, which is found there in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. But we came to understand that what this does not mean is how it is sometimes understood. It does not mean that everything is meaningless, or everything is pointless, or everything is futile. The word vanity here is the Hebrew word hevel. And hevel literally means breath, or wind, or vapor. And it figuratively is speaking to that which is passing, short-lived, momentary. So what does vanity of vanities mean? Well, perhaps one science professor helps when he says it in another way. Soap bubbles, soap bubbles, all is soap bubbles. What does he mean by that? The bubbles are delightfully beautiful, multicolored, shimmering globes, dancing in the air and gracefully changing their form until, poof, they disappear in a brief, shiny cascade of tiny droplets. The soap bubbles are beautiful, but they're insubstantial. They're delightful, but they're ephemeral. They're momentary, just like life. We considered a multitude of other illustrations last time. Helium-filled balloons, smoke from a snuffed-out candle, grass, the Bible's apparently favorite illustration of vanity. These are the illustrations of life. And we talked about the concept then that if everything is hevel, what does this mean for us? Well, it means for us, first of all, life is short. We don't live or last long in this world. We need to come to terms with the brevity of this life. How long does candle smoke last when it's been snuffed out? It's momentary. How long does grass last? Maybe you won't cut it and it will grow up very high and maybe you'll get a fine. I don't know. But the point is that winter cometh. We were born with an expiration date. And so life is short. But life is also elusive. Life is hevel, therefore it is elusive. We have no real sovereignty or control over the details and circumstances of our lives. Can you grab that smoke as it rises from the candle? No. Can you tame the grass to grow on your terms? Stop. It is summer and I don't want to mow. You can't do that. In the same way, you cannot tame this world and this life. You can't take hold of it. You can't pin it down. You can't make it produce consistent and predictable outcomes. In fact, you are unable to even fully comprehend this life. Life itself resists your attempts to just sum it all up. Life is elusive. And so, everything is hevel. Now, hevel is not to be understood fatalistically. And we have to spend a moment reviewing because what we did last time connects very much into what we're going to do today. It's not to be understood fatalistically. This is not a deterministic book. It doesn't matter what you do. Just go on and be carried by this life. No. The preacher, the one in verse 1, the one who speaks these words, who writes these words, he's helping us to come to terms with the fact that this life is uncontrollable. It will not be manipulated or engineered or coaxed to your will. As we hear in Psalm 39, surely every man walks about as a ghost. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. Or maybe it's understood by a commentator who says, we imagine that we can make a difference in the world and accomplish things of lasting significance. After all, that's why we go to work each day. It's why we have a midlife crisis also when we look back and we see that who we are and what we've done doesn't seem to amount to very much. Therefore, if we come to terms with the fact that life is short and life is elusive, and we're going to come to two more concepts about life today, we'll at least see that whatever our goals and our desires and our commitments are, we really ought to line these up with reality and not be in defiance of reality. Here, if I could put it in a word then, here's what the preacher, Kohelet, that's the Hebrew word Kohelet, and I'll refer to him sometimes as Kohelet. This is what the preacher is really saying. Everything in this life is fleeting, fading, and frustrating. It is fleeting, fading, and frustrating. And in saying this matter-of-factly, the preacher is drawing us into a dialogue about living in a world that God made and God called good, and yet by all appearances and experiences, a world that is as difficult as it is temporary. He knows his audience will object. What do you mean all is vanity, preacher? Life is filled with purpose and productivity and promotion. It has to be. There's much to contribute to life, and there's also much to gain from life. There's a legacy to leave. There are accomplishments to one day be acknowledged. I am to be remembered. I am to be memorialized. And you see how this is the logic. These are the arguments against such a concept that this life, everything in this life is fleeting, fading, and frustrating. See, but the preacher anticipates your protest. And so he asks in verse 3, the first of his many reflective rhetorical questions. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Now, this preacher is not setting you up. This preacher wants to pull you in. This preacher wants to engage your understanding of reality. This preacher wants to share wisdom with you and to let you in on God's perspective. Ultimately, this book is intended to bring together the reality of this world with the reality of the world to come. But we have to start here. We have to start with the realization and the recognition everything in this life is vanity. Now these, I have an outline. It's in the bulletin. I want to move through verses 3 through 11 this morning. We're going to spend our first point in verse 3, looking at the question. We must understand the question that is being put before us. Even this can be misunderstood. And then we want to look at the answer in verses 4 to 11 and what is being implied in that answer. And you can see there's a number of things that I want to highlight in the answer. But first, let's consider the question in verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And so let's understand the vocabulary of some of the things we find in this question. The first one is this. What advantage does man have? What advantage? This word advantage is used 9 times in this book. So you can tell that this question coming up here is simply preparing us for future statements and future arguments by the preacher. And the word advantage here is sometimes translated gain. What is there to gain? Or profit? What is the profit of our work? And this word is a financial term. It suggests something left over, something that remains in the end. But here, more is intended than mere material wealth. After my labors are complete, at the end of my life, I desire to be in the black. I desire not to have any debts, but to have something of a profit earned. I'm working to secure a surplus. I want my life to count for something. I want something to show for it all. And that is the word here for advantage. What can I show for all of my work? Some think that the preacher, in asking this question, is implying that there's absolutely no gain from a life full of work. Now, that question is not yet going to be answered in chapter 1, but I want to be clear with you. The Bible does not have this universal no gain view of life. That's not what's being said here. In fact, you can think about other portions of Scripture that would speak contrary to that view. Paul writes realistically to Timothy, telling him, we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. You might say, well, that sounds a lot like what's being said here. But see, even in that passage, the very next thing that Paul says is he encourages Timothy that godliness is a means of great gain in this life when it is accompanied by contentment. So even though we have not brought anything physical into this world, nor will we carry anything physically out of this world, yet there are things to gain from this world. Solomon, too, in this very book, will highlight gain in this short life. In chapter 2, verse 13, he says, I saw that there's more profit in wisdom than in folly, just as there's more profit in light than in darkness. So, you see, wisdom provides some gain. It gives life to the one who possesses it in chapter 7, verse 12. It gives success to the one who applies it in this passing world in chapter 10, verse 10. Solomon is not saying here that there's nothing to gain in this life. He's saying that there's nothing, there's no material advantage. There's no surplus that I can bring with me. Jesus Himself highlights the true gain of this life in that we pursue a soul gain offered to us within the context of His own work and salvation. Consider His words in Matthew 16, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? That's the kind of gain we're talking about. How much of the world can I gain from my work in this life? And the rhetorical answer is nothing. But the preacher knows that you and I want too much from ourselves, from our labors in this life. And that's why he's saying this. He's confronting a particular perspective of a worldly gain. The second thing I want you to understand in this question then is this. He uses this phrase, under the sun. This is used 30 times in this book. You can understand then how important this is. And let me say very clearly, under the sun is not speaking of a world down here apart from God who is up there. Under the sun is not talking about a life lived without God. That is a very popular view. And in fact, there are Reformed commentators who will say that's what this means. Under the sun means a life lived without God. But I want you to notice that the preacher is not speaking about a life without God. He's speaking about a life that is experienced by both the believer and the unbeliever. We're all under the sun. He's not talking about a secular mindset that lends its interpretation to Ecclesiastes being an evangelistic tract against a secular mindset. No, no, no. The preacher's not speaking about a fatalistic or a meaningless life. He's not talking about life without God. He's talking about what our world is like, what reality is like for humanity. In fact, let us rightly understand that the phrase under the sun does not mark a particular location like down here. Rather, it marks a time period. Under the sun, life is the here and now life that we experience every day. One commentator says this, in Scripture, the sun is a marker of time. And the phrase under the sun refers to a now rather than a there. Now, why is that important? Because you must understand that under the sun is a figurative language for this life, however long it is lived. Whether you're born and tragically you pass away that day, you lived momentarily under the sun, or whether you have those 70 or 80 years that we sung about earlier, that is your life under the sun. So what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Let's come back to the question as a whole then. What kind of worldly advantage does man have from his work and in this life? Well, life is short. It cannot be controlled. But the preacher is going to answer this question. He's going to make some implications in verses 4 to 11. And we're going to see are these two things. That life is also repetitive, and that life is without worldly profit. One commentator says this: you read verses 4 to 11, and everything either goes around and around, or it comes and it goes, and it rises, it sets. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. What is present will soon be past. And there's a particular cycle and a repetition and a rhythm that's shown forth here. And we are people who get stuck in the rut of it all. And that's what he wants to highlight for us. So let's move secondly. Our second point is the answer. The answer. And you can see in the bulletin it says the argument, this and that. I'll tell you what they are on the front end just so you can see what they are, but then we'll walk through all this. First of all, in verse 4, he gives us the argument simply stated. Simply stated, here's the answer. And then we see the argument illustrated in two things that life is repetitive. The argument illustrated, life is repetitive. He's going to use the sun and the wind for that. And then the argument illustrated, life is profitless. Life is profitless. And he's going to use the rivers and man for that. And then finally, the argument restated. There's nothing new. There's nothing to gain. There's nothing new. Okay. So I'll repeat these, but I just want you to have them on the front end just so you can orient yourself to the answer here. So first, we see that in verse 4, in his answer, that he simply states the answer. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. And what we have is a parallel, which is very common in wisdom literature. Two things being compared, two things being contrasted, and this is a contrasting parallel. He speaks about the brevity of human life compared with the permanence of the land in which we live and labor. Literally, it says, the land forever stands. Which, if you think about it, is something of a hat tip all the way back to Genesis, where God promised that He was going to not destroy the earth by a flood again. The earth forever stands. Not because the earth is anything special. God is the one who is causing the earth to stand, even though he doesn't explicitly state it here. But there's a contrasting parallel, not only with the brevity of human life and the permanence of the land. You can look at the poetic order. It's not a common order. It's actually an uncommon order, and it's intended to get our attention. Think about this. If I were to speak about things coming and going, I would say it just like that. You know, a generation comes and a generation goes. This generation comes and it goes. But that's not what it says. What it says is a generation goes and another one comes. It's as if to say that something replaces another thing. And so, in this replacement, what's being highlighted is that there is a cyclical change. And though there is a cyclical change, though we experience a continual change of things, in reality, nothing changes. The land forever stands. There's no gain, though there is a perpetual cycle of generations. There's a new generation coming, but what advantage has come about because of that? Nothing. We can think of it like this: fathers go and children come, and none stay. Or, I know some of you rent apartments to people. Tenants go and tenants come, but the house remains without gain. Without real gain. Here is the preacher's answer. All of your work in this life will not give you an advantage or the kind of advantage you may be seeking and desiring in the end of it all, at death. And so there's the argument simply stated in this one illustration. But then he moves on with further illustrations. And these first two, it's interesting how you divide this up, and I'm just highlighting this because it's not always easy to determine how you're going to highlight this. You can see in verse 5, it talks about the sun rising and setting. In verse 6, the wind moving on along its circuit. In verse 7, the rivers flowing. And then in verse 8, we have man not able to speak it or being satisfied with his seeing and ear filled with hearing. And so you might think, oh, there's the three and three, you know, sun and wind and river and talking and seeing and hearing. I think there's something else here. Really, what we have are two themes connected in verses 5 and 6. That is the theme of repetition, redundancy. The sun rises, the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. And this is where you've got to love the illustrative language, hastening. Literally, it says panting. You can imagine the sun. Children, can you see it? The sun panting, trying to get back to its place again so it can do its work all over again the next day. In the Septuagint, it uses the language dragging. 365 times a year in treadmill-like repetition, the sun continues repeatedly to do its work. One pastor says, like the hypocrite at his prayers, the sun engages in vain repetition. And when the sun goes down, we have every expectation of seeing it again, but it does not necessarily expect to see us again. We don't remain, but the sun does. And then in verse 6, another illustration of life being repetitious. Blowing toward the south, turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular course the wind returns. The wind swirls and swirls and twirls, and yet it only travels limitedly along the earth. In fact, it often returns for a visit where it has come before. Life is repetitive. You washed the dishes last night, and the same ones will need to be washed again. Kids, you have the same laundry baskets to put away every week. The bills will need to be paid again this month. Life is repetitive. But not only are the things of this world redundant, they are also without much gain. And here is 2.3, or our next point. The argument illustrated, life is profitless. Life is profitless. Look at verse 7. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. And here, there is that repetition. Certainly, you can see that, the cycle of the rivers and the seas. But notice the emphasis here has to do with the filling up. They don't fill up. They don't gain. There's not a material advantage to all of this cycle. Not only is there a repetition, there is a fruitless repetition. The Mediterranean Sea is continually being fed by multiple rivers, and yet it never overflows. The weather report is not going to tell us something different tomorrow. Also, verse 8, all things are wearisome. Man's not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with the seeing. You see, that's the theme of being filled up. The ear is, nor is the ear filled with hearing. See, there is a weariness to this repetitive, profitless life. We do our work. Whether our work is doing our schoolwork, whether our work is doing our work in the home, whether our work is going to our job and doing our work, we do our work, and with fatigue, we come to the close of the day, or maybe we come to the beginning of the day, but it's time to go to bed. And we try not to think about the fact that we need to do it again when we get up again. And that's in part because the work is never done. The work is never done. And if we cannot come to completion, then we cannot build surplus. You understand what I'm saying? If the work is never done, how do we come to a place of gain? Even our eyes and our ears cannot fill up to the full. We never reach satisfaction. And this is in part because there's always room for more. There's always room for more. There's always room for ice cream, right, Tom? There's always room for more. And since the sun and the wind and the seas and all of the creation do not and cannot gain from their labors, why would we assume that we mere humans would or could gain from our labors in this life? It's not true of the massive reality of the whole world. Why would I deceive myself in thinking it would be true for me? But because the preacher could be misunderstood as saying that there's nothing to be gained in this life, and because he loves wise words, he provides another imaginative way of saying that life is without gain under the sun. And he does this in verses 9 through 11. And so this is the argument restated. There's nothing new. There's no gain, and there's nothing new. Look at verse 9. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done, so that there's nothing new under the sun. You hear, one of the things he's saying right there is, this is not only our present experience, but consider human history. This is not just, you know, an issue for us today. This is the way it's always been. The experience of the past will be the experience of the future. And all future events are simply past events repeated. And therefore, there is nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new in the span of life that you get. Now, let me be clear what this means. There's nothing new. Our family sat around reading this recently and had a really fun time talking about what there's nothing new means. And our kids were trying to come up with all kinds of new things, and we were trying to help them understand, yeah, but that's not new. This does not mean that there are no new inventions. There has not always been an iPhone or even a smartphone. Mr. Van Sickle put in these new thermometers that he can control from his phone. That's new. But that's not what this is talking about. Nor does this mean that people won't experience new things. Rather, what this means, there's nothing new, is that there is nothing completely different in this life to be discovered that could somehow break the perpetual and profitless cycle of life and in that way bring fulfillment or lasting satisfaction to us. Not only is there not some worldly gain in our work, but there is not something completely different that will emerge from our work. The thing that'll be the thing of things and will finally help us to come to a place of enjoyment, satisfaction, completion. Technology. You might think, well, technology is new. No. Technology is simply a form of communication. And it is ever changing, and yet it still is limited in terms of what it is doing. It helps us to communicate. That's it. Exploration in this space, you say, that's new. Yeah, but exploration in this space is still exploration into uncharted territory. That's all it is. Just more territory to discover. But you know what? We've done that. How is that a new thing that will somehow break the repetition? You know, the repetition that existed, the repetition and profitlessness that existed in the days of getting into big ships and looking for new trade routes is the same kind of repetition and, if you will, vanity that exists for those who get into ships and go into space. New babies. Yeah, but they're still babies. And there's been a lot of them under the sun. Ah, new year. Yep. And it'll be like last year in many ways. We don't lose the shortness of life. We don't lose the elusiveness of life. We don't lose the repetition of life. We don't lose the profitlessness of life. We don't lose any of those things. They're still there, even in that which is new for us. And so we hope to come across something new and significant in this life that will break the monotonous reoccurrence of our boredom. And yet there's nothing new. There's nothing to gain. In fact, when someone says, I found something new, even that error isn't new. Look at verse 10. Is there anything of which one might say, see this, it's new? Already it's existed for ages, which were before us. And you know, that puts a big smirk on my face because when he says it's already existed for ages, you understand that he's speaking of a day that are ancient to us. Ancient to us. So, returning then to the point made in verse 4. Within the cycle of generations, none stand out. Most are forgotten. I mean, most people. Look at verse 11. There's no remembrance of earlier things and also the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. And so verses 4 to 11 is the answer to the preacher's question. And he's saying all of your work in this life will not give you any kind of worldly advantage in the end. Rather, you will find that life is fleeting, fading, and frustrating. And what he's doing is, wonderfully, he is pulling us away from hoping in the things of this life. The preacher is helping us to prepare for our death so that we can learn how to live in this life under the sun. If the reality of the brevity of this life sinks in, if we get it, then it will automatically lead to another question. And here's the question. If we won't live forever, or even long enough to make a lasting difference to the world, how then should we live? How then should we live? And friends, that's what much of this book is about. That's where he's taking us. This is not pessimism. This is realism. Now with that, I want to give you two applications for today in these first verses. Two applications. The first one is this. Don't make too much or too little of this life under the sun. Don't make too much or too little of this life under the sun. You make too much of this life when you cannot admit or even see that this life is brief, that this life is temporary, that this life cannot provide worldly gain through your labors. We trust in this life too much. And this reality is helping us to stop doing that. It's to bring us to terms with the limits of this life. David Gibson calls this playing pretend. He says, while we know that we're going to die, we spend much of our time not accepting that reality. We spend much of our energy playing pretend. Consider what he says. Let's pretend that if we get the promotion or see our church grow or bring up good children, we'll feel significant and leave a lasting legacy behind us. Let's pretend that if we change jobs, we won't experience the humdrum tedium and ordinariness of life. And let's pretend that if we move to a new house or immigrate to the sun, we'll be happier and we'll never want to move again. Let's pretend that if we end one relationship and start a new one, we won't ever feel trapped. Let's pretend that if we were married or were not married, we'd be content. Let's pretend that if we had more money, then we'd be satisfied. Or if we get through this week's pile of washing and dirty diapers and shopping lists and school runs and busy evenings, next week will be quieter. Let's pretend that time is always on our side to do the things we want to do and become the people we want to be. Let's pretend we can break the cycle of repetition and finally arrive in a world free from weariness. We need to stop pretending. We need Ecclesiastes to help us to do that. And so we need to not make too much of this life, but we also need to, on the other hand, not make too little of this life. When you ignore the ordinary events of life, you make too little of it. You miss wonderful things that you were intended to not miss, but to enjoy. We do not take the time to enjoy a quiet evening spent with family or the small joys that occur from time to time in our relationships or the humor of a moment that is forgotten by the end of the day. And Ecclesiastes, the preacher, is going to say much about that as well. That we don't want to make too little of what is in this life. But all of it is to bring us to God. So don't make too much or too little of this life under the sun. Secondly, understand the God-designed balance of both change and permanence. Understand the God-designed balance of change and permanence. Spring is here again. And this particular spring feels new. It is both something that is repetitious and something that is permanent. God has given us a repetitive cycle of change that will not become something completely different in this life, but that will balance for us both change and permanence, again, so that we will be drawn closer to Him. David Gibson, who I've already quoted in the previous application point, I quote here, and I guess now I will reveal to you that David Gibson is probably one of the most helpful authors I've read in the book of Ecclesiastes. Living Life Backward is his book. He provides an illustration that actually C.S. Lewis gives of this very point, understanding the God-designed balance of change and permanence, in his book, The Screwtape Letters. And in The Screwtape Letters, there's a senior devil, Screwtape, and he's writing to his junior devil nephew, Wormwood, and he's giving him advice on how to get Christians to turn away from their enemy, who is God. And Screwtape focuses in one portion of on one of his letters, he focuses on our constant desire to experience something new. He says to Wormwood, "The horror of the same old thing is one of the most valuable passions we have produced in the human heart. An endless source of heresies in religion, folly in counsel, infidelity in marriage, and inconstancy in friendship." And so what Lewis is acknowledging here through the mouth of this devil is that God has made change and newness a joy to humanity. But because God does not want us, His creatures, to make change an end in itself, He has balanced our love for change with a love for permanence. And so again, consider Screwtape as he seeks to undermine this and trip us up in it. Now, just as we pick out and exaggerate the pleasure of eating to produce gluttony, so we pick out this natural pleasantness of change and twist it into a demand for absolute novelty. Absolute novelty meaning we must have something new all the time. That's why we not only, you understand, buy stuff online all the time, but we have wish lists. Absolute novelty. This demand is entirely our workmanship. If we neglect our duty, men will not only be contented, but transported by the mixture of novelty and familiarity of snowdrops this January, sunrises this morning, plum pudding this winter. Until we have taught them better, children will be perfectly happy playing winter games in winter and summer games in summer instead of being disappointed all the time about their playing. Only by our continuous effort is the demand for infinite or unrhythmical change kept up. Friends, this is exactly where the preacher wants us to be sensitive. Where you are unsatisfied with repetition in your life, it is because you are pretending that things should not be like this for you in this life. And where you find yourself unsatisfied with the permanence of the things in this life, the same is true. So we each live under the sun. On this side of eternity, life is a vapor, a wind, and we die. Our children do the same, generation after generation, until Christ returns. And we understand then that this preacher's question is intended to help us to think about the kind of gain that is not found in our labors in this life. And he will open more of that up. But the preacher exposed the repetition and profitlessness of our work and in this life, so that we would learn not to be discontented by such things, but rather draw near to God. Well, may the Lord give us grace and help as we continue to work through this book and draw near to God, asking the question, how should we then live? May He give us answers from His Word. Amen.